It is Sunday, March 3rd, 2013, and this is episode 9 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. As always, my thoughts and opinions are my own and do not represent those of my employer. I'm recording today from a very windy Las Vegas, Nevada, so you may hear some background noise. I apologize for that. It's been another very busy week in information security, so let's go ahead and get started with some stories. The first thing I want to talk about comes from Brian Krebs, and it is a denial of service attack against Bank of the West. Now, I'm not one that really gets excited about denial of service attacks, but this one is really interesting in that it was used to mask theft of about $900,000 from one of the bank's customers. So apparently, some thieves figured out a way to transfer just about $1 million from the account of Ascent Builders to some other account, and then proceeded to try to mask their trail by performing a denial of service attack against the bank. So in the wake of the fraud, it apparently Brian Krebs actually notified the customer Ascent Builders. They tried to get online and check their account, but of course they weren't unable to because their site was down. The customer called the bank. The bank said everything was great. But a couple days later, of course, the money was long gone. This kind of highlights how attackers can weave together different levels of complexity of attacks where they can get incident responders tied up dealing with a more simple, possibly higher visibility attack. Meanwhile, something much more nefarious is happening in the background. In this particular case, the delay in time actually was a significant enabler in the success of the attack. And I guess the other thing I'll say is if you're a financial services company and you don't have a contract with your ISP for denial of service mitigation, I really think you're missing the boat. All right, moving on. Next story is Bible.org was compromised in serving up malware. This is not a very complicated attack, and it is very reminiscent of what we've seen in the past with NBC and some of the others, iPhone, devsdk.com, as an example. But it is just another example of a trusted site, trusted implicitly by many because of its religious affiliation. To me, this continues to highlight a growing trend of needing to be somewhat suspicious about even trustworthy sites. Now, there was a little bit more detail on the Bible.org attack. Actually, one of the AV vendors did a write-up that indicated that the iframe injected malware actually did some amount of anti-forensics. So basically what it was doing is it had a bit of code in there that only activated upon a mouse movement. And so if it didn't detect a mouse movement, the malware or the exploit actually didn't trigger. And so the idea there being that they're trying to really hit systems where there's an actual human in front of the keyboard and not some automated web crawler that is trying to classify malicious sites. All right, next story is an update about the Bit9 attack. I've got to say, it's really very refreshing to see a company be fairly transparent with what happened and not just say we solved the problem. So the update there is that a internet-facing server had some kind of an SQL injection vulnerability, and that enabled an attacker to connect to apparently a test virtual machine that was brought up for a fairly limited amount of time. That virtual machine didn't have all the requisite security software on it, and the attackers were able to get on and steal a signing certificate that was there. So to me, it kind of highlights some awareness of the environment of the Bit9 network by the attackers, but we really don't know much more than what they've released. In any event, hopefully the trend for transparency will continue. The next story is actually very much related to the Bit9, and that is there's another Java Zero Day, which I don't think is news, because that, I believe, has been the news story for each of the last three or four podcasts. And by the way, they are all different Java Zero Days, not the same one. So Symantec and FireEye have been seeing exploitation of the most recent Zero Day and the payload being delivered by this exploit is actually a piece of malware signed by the Bit9 certificate, which was stolen. So I'm going to continue to be a broken record here and say, if you don't need Java, uninstall Java. If you do need Java, try to uninstall it from your browser or uninstall the browser plugin functionality. And if you really, really need the browser plugin functionality, try to find some way to run that in a sandbox or use NoScript or some other way to limit the exposure. We're just seeing a firestorm of Java Zero Days, and each one of them seems to be actively exploited. These are not academic problems. These are actually negatively impacting lots of people out there. Well, continuing on the theme of the Java Zero Day, I talked a bit about the Facebook, Apple, Microsoft announcement of being hacked by a Java Zero Day that was posted on a compromised iPhone development site. Well, since then, the name of the site actually has been released. What I want to talk about here is actually how the owner of that site came to understand what was going on. So just to refresh, there was a very common, very popular iPhone development software website called iPhone@devsdk.com, which is, as you might imagine, a fairly substantial hub for iPhone development. Facebook announced that they were hacked, and there was a lot of hoopla around how they detected it and whatnot. Apple announced that they were hacked, and then Microsoft in turn announced they were hacked, all by the same bug on the same website. Well, what was really interesting here is that the moderator, or the owner of the iPhoneDevSDK.com site, has come out and said that he learned of his site being compromised in serving up this exploit by reading a story on All Things D. And that's really unfortunate. I certainly had made an assumption, and obviously a bad assumption, that once Facebook and Apple and Microsoft had realized what happened and where the exploit originated from, that they might have actually contacted the owner of that site. And I'm really disappointed to find out that's apparently not the case. If you look in the show notes, you can find a link to the announcement by the owner of the iPhone Dev SDK site. So it's hard for me to say if this is real or imagined, but it certainly seems like the tactic of using watering hole attacks is becoming more common. And I think the thing we all need to really take to heart here is that these are legitimate websites that have been compromised, and people are going to them for valid reasons, and they're getting compromised. This isn't people going to a porn site or to a gambling site. They're going to NBC.com. They're going to Bible.org. They're going to iPhoneDevSDK.com for a legitimate reason. Between this and email, I think if anything we can learn from the APT1 report, as I mentioned last week, is that people are really becoming the major weakness in our defenses, it's far harder for an attacker to penetrate a firewall and get through DS, IPS, and all of those things than it is just to get someone to click on a link, go to a web page that they normally go to anyway, open up an attachment in an email. Those things are way easier than actually hitting an organization head on. And I'm just not seeing the sense of urgency out in the industry like I would expect in response to this. You know, when we had people trying to compromise web servers, if we had people trying to compromise database servers and all these things, and you know, that drove a ton of IT security investment and lots of thought, lots of books, lots of talks. But we just, as an industry, seem to be sitting on our asses about user security. I apparently feel that education is the solution, more antivirus is the solution, and maybe even some application whitelisting, which for the most part works, but as we've seen, even that is not infallible. So I find it pretty frustrating that there just doesn't seem to be this sense of urgency, as I've said, around this problem. Maybe that's going to change. Maybe the Mandiant report will spur some new thought around this. I don't know, but I'm just not seeing it so far. At a minimum, organizations should be rolling out web filtering and blocking known bad sites. It's not perfect by any means, just like application whitelisting isn't perfect. But when you put enough screens up, you're going to catch a lot of things. As I mentioned last week with NBC, you know, it was not long after the site was compromised that a lot of the web filtering companies were actually both blocking NBC or listing NBC.com as suspicious and outright blocking the iframe-linked domains serving the actual exploit as malicious. So if you were blocking suspicious and malicious sites, your employees would have been protected, assuming they weren't some of the first people to actually go to the site. The other thing people really should be thinking of is trying to reduce the surface area. You know, we talked for decades about surface area as it relates to threats, but generally we haven't really thought that way in terms of workstations. And so, for instance, not having Flash or PDF Reader or Java, those things are going to help protect the integrity of systems. And now I know most people or most organizations actually need those things. Finding a way to containerize them, protect them, put them into an environment where they can't actually do harm is, in my opinion, growing ever more important. I think where my head is at on this is that, and I know this is controversial, is browsing the internet and doing those sorts of things on a workstation with access to important data and applications and other business systems just doesn't make sense anymore. There isn't an effective way to protect against, you know, all of the threats out there. And it's not just web browsing either. You know, look at the APT1 report and what was the most cited method of exploitation, and it's email. You know, I know for me personally, I probably get 2 to 3 phishing emails a day that contain some kind of malware. I don't know that they're particularly targeted. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. But in most cases, when I get them, they're not being detected by the AV vendors. Now, I'll caveat that and say they're not being detected as I submit them to VirusTotal, and we all know how that is fraught with problems. So yes, I realize that it's entirely possible that heuristic engines would have picked it up However, I'm really not interested in spinning up sacrificial virtual machines to see if different AV engines will pick them up. I don't have that kind of time. I'm sorry. But the point is that they're becoming very common, and we know they're effective. We know from Mandiant's report how effective they are. You know, why do we need these very big and sophisticated attacks when we can package up a malicious PDF or even an executable with some tricky name and spoof the from address, and you're going to get a very high percentage of people opening that thing. So I ask, how do you protect against that? There just isn't an effective solution. Again, application whitelisting is probably the best thing I can think of, but again, it isn't a foolproof solution. And in a lot of organizations, it's just too complicated. There are just too many different pieces of software, too many exceptions, and on and on. And speaking of malware-laden attachments in phishing emails, one of the things that happened after Mandiant released his report is a version of that report came out and was being emailed around, but with the moniker of APT2 instead of APT1. But the PDF actually contained an exploit using the recently disclosed zero-day in PDF reader. So interestingly, this one was actually targeting really the defense and defender population among us. So actually going after the security people who really should know better. I don't know specifically of anyone actually falling for it. However, it's hard to see, given that security people are human too, how at least a few people didn't fall for it. All right, next story. At RSA, there was a fairly neat and maybe questionable thing done. The Kalios botnet was actually resurrected a while back, and in front of a live audience at the RSA conference, the botnet was shut down, and they had all sorts of pretty lights to show how it was being taken offline, and infected bots were actually being taken offline and deactivated. The obvious question there is, why wait if you have the ability to do that? Why not do it as you are able to, rather than waiting for a PR stunt? And, you know, what if you're some of the people who were impacted in the days or weeks between when you developed that capability and your stunt at the conference? But I'm not going to deny the PR aspect. I mean, it is a pretty splashy thing to be able to do in front of a live audience. No questions about that. All right, the next story is about something called Miniduke. Miniduke is a malware APT campaign against some European government agencies, including NATO. Nothing terribly innovative. I believe it used some new zero days in PDF reader propagated by email, intended to steal documents. I think we've heard the story a couple times before. So speaking of phishing, this isn't a new story, but something I've been thinking about. We all have phishing education or anti-phishing education at our organizations, which are intended to try to avoid people from falling for these things. And it occurred to me, one of the key tenets in that is not to open attachments that you aren't expecting from someone. So if your friend Bob sends you an attachment and you're not expecting it, don't open it. It's fairly straightforward advice. But personally, I've noticed an interesting tactic evolving with some of these phishers. And that's to actually send an email to you with a malicious attachment, but actually addressed to somebody you know. And for me personally, I've seen it where these emails are addressed to either coworkers of mine or to actually my wife, who shares an email address at my domain. And I think the idea here is that even for people who are properly trained to not open attachments that they're not expecting, you know, the idea is to really go after their curiosity and exploit just the human condition where we want to peek at what our spouse is getting and what our coworker is getting. So I've seen some of that have had attachment names like payroll report, and some of the ones that were addressed to my wife were related to bills and invoices. And so you can kind of see how, just as a human, there's going to be this desire, this curiosity to actually look at what your wife is or what your husband is actually getting that they might be hiding from you, you know, heaven forbid. And taking it back to the phishing education point, we tell people not to open up attachments that they're not expecting. However, we're not telling them to not open attachments that appear to be misrouted to somebody else, because, hey, you know what? My coworker may very well have been expecting this payroll report. My wife very well may have been expecting this invoice. And I just don't know it. And darn it, I'm curious and I want to look at it. So just something to think about for your future phishing awareness education campaigns. All right, next up is Symantec announced that it discovered what people are calling the 0.5 version of Stuxnet. And this actually dates back to 2005, which is about 2 years before the Stuxnet that we have come to know and love, which was discovered back in 2010. Symantec actually released a pretty long report about this bit of malware, but the synopsis is it was designed to be a little more targeted instead of really just going in and damaging lots of crap at a uranium processing facility. It was very targeted at turning off a couple of valves, which would have a effect of limiting the flow of uranium hexafluoride into some of these centrifuges, which ultimately would cause the uranium already in the centrifuges to solidify, and that would in turn gum up the works and cause irreparable harm to the facility. Apparently that didn't work out so well, and so it's theorized that the version of Stuxnet that we ended up finding in 2010 was far more aggressive, and that's actually what we saw get in and disable or damage the facility in Iran. Now, I have read, and I didn't include a link to it, so if you're interested in this, you can go do your own research. I have read that the Natanz facility, which we believe Stuxnet was intended to disable, wasn't actually processing uranium until 2007. So that kind of says, well, what were they actually going after back in 2005? I don't know the answer to that offhand. All right, my last story is about Evernote. Unless you've been living under a rock for the past couple of days, you are very well aware that Evernote had their database compromised and all of their user IDs, which are email addresses, and hashed passwords were stolen. The company is very explicit in saying that no data was stolen. However, you know, we've seen this story play out over and over again. The password list is stolen. Attackers go off and reverse engineer or brute force decrypt as many passwords as they can, and now they're off attacking Amazon accounts, bank accounts, email accounts and so on. So this is a pretty significant one, because apparently there are 50 million accounts potentially involved. I know for me, I personally was notified by Evernote that my ID, in fact, was impacted. And Evernote's been taking some heat over the past couple of days because they do not offer two-factor authentication as an option. This is really becoming kind of a de facto standard pretty quickly, and the web properties that don't support it seem to be falling behind. So, you know, we know Facebook and Google support it, but for instance, Twitter and Evernote don't. There is another somewhat funny bit to the story, and that's that in the email delivered by Evernote, there's an explicit line in there that says, do not click on a link in an email prompting you to reset your password, i.e., you know, they're trying to help you avoid phishing scams. However, and humorously, they actually have a link to Evernote, and if you actually look at the link, it isn't directly to Evernote. It's through a marketing partner called Silverpop, and they do things like collecting campaign metrics and that sort of stuff for mass emails. It's not hard to see why somebody like Evernote would want to outsource the processing of 50 million emails, but I think they probably should have thought twice about how they represented those links in their email. And this is the part where I get in my soapbox about using a different password for every single web service, email address, account, everything that you have. This is so critically important now, and it's something we need to help our friends and families to understand. I like to think that most people who are listening to this podcast are painfully aware of this, but we have a kind of a civic duty to make sure that people are off doing this. It's really critically important. And to that end, I say stop trying to memorize your passwords. Give it up. Adopt a password manager. Let the password manager generate some obnoxiously long password. Use the copy and paste functionality. Have a different password for every service. You can buy or download free password managers that will sync across different devices. I understand it's not as good as two-factor. Completely agree with that. However, it's just becoming untenable that we continue to have passwords that are very weakly hashed, using inappropriate algorithms. And by the way, I'm not asserting that Evernote did use an inappropriate algorithm, because I don't specifically know what they used, but I'm going to assume that they used something like SHA-1, any of the SHAs, which just aren't appropriate. So these web companies will continue to get compromised. They will continue to lose your password. Attackers will continue to get better at cracking them much faster, and they're going to make your life hell. All right, enough of that rant. I'm going to cut the show off now and actually go try to find some Las Vegas nightlife to partake in. I appreciate everyone listening to the show. Again, if you like the show, please give me feedback on iTunes. Certainly, if you don't like the show, don't give me any feedback. You can send questions or comments to info@defensivesecurity.org or on Twitter @DefensiveSec. And I will talk to you all again next week. Have a great one. Bye.